something like it anyway. Yeah. Very, very close. So it's you know, the critique, I think, is fair. What I really hate, honestly, and I love a good David Lynch impersonation, but I hate that every time he reads from Lynch, he does it in his David Lynch voice.
Oh, that's dumb. That's annoying.
Yeah, and yeah.
As somebody who's been doing David Lynch impressions nonstop for like 2 weeks now, I don't care for that.
I'm not a big fan of that. But I also did not like the Twitch streamer wraparound either on the other one.
Yeah,
so.
I'm interested in sort of the essayists who she does it. Patrick Willems does it. I think Philosophy Tube does it. A lot of essayists are doing the like kind of wraparound like framing story
kayfabe of it. Yeah,
I think to try to crack through the noise and that sort of, I mean, there's just so many video essayists, I think it makes sense.
They all want to be filmmakers and they can't.
Some of them do. I mean, sure.
I think that's Willems, where Will is at.
For sure. Hey, it's tough to be a filmmaker. Nobody wants to give money to movies.
Yeah, the no mid-budget movies. I heard it at the Oscars.
That's right. Cord. Oh, yeah. That's, we haven't, there was an Oscars between last we sat down and now.
Yeah.
I mean, it was fun.
Yeah, it was.
Sure, it was fine.
I enjoyed it.
I did too.
Yeah, it was as good an Oscars as I've ever seen the show.
It was solid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you're right, Arthur. You made the correct noise. We don't have time for that. We got to put a capper on David Lynch.
Unless
this week.
Just want to talk about John Mulaney and Ryan Gosling, then.
We can do that.
Otherwise, I have nothing to
John Mulaney and Ryan Gosling, directed by David Lynch.
I'm there for it.
I think they both would fit into sort of his rhythms quite well.
Mm-hmm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast, where we get the round table. We discuss the films you'll never discuss in a film space course, unless we're in a marathon in which we break all the rules. This week, we're doing our very first ever director's marathon. We're bringing it into the station with our last entry of the films of David Lynch for the month of March. I don't even know where it is.
March.
Where we are. What is happening?
We entered the Red Room. We spoke backwards. We, you know, drank so much coffee. Dustin,
I was going to buy pie.
Oh.
That's all right.
Rats.
I had pie for breakfast yesterday. It's a long story. Dustin.
Yes.
This is your selection.
Yes.
This month it is a host pick for you. And I'm so glad Arthur made sure to program this marathon around your host pick.
Yes, I am too. And I'm, you know, this is.
What would you have picked?
If I had the Lynch host pick, I would probably have made us do Eraserhead again. Was that a main feed show? Yeah. I guess it was.
That was when you and Heath were at that place.
Yeah. And then obviously Mulholland was episode 100. So maybe we would have done Elephant Man. I would have been interested. I would to kind of go off, to, you know, the one that sort of got him widespread industry acceptance. I think that would have been an interesting one
his
to examine.
His studio success, so to speak.
Yes, since we started with Dune as his big studio failure. But instead, we did the most fanboy option.
Yes.
And did the Twin Peaks movie.
Yes, the most obscure, perhaps, of all of them. I don't know. I don't know that it's all that obscure. But, oh, I'm still Dustin.
I'm still Arthur.
I am still Dalton. I was going to have some sort of Bob joke. I don't have it in me.
I'll put you in my death bag.
I've seen it. It exists.
In case you're tuning into the show for the very first time, dear listener, we want to warn you at this time that this is an analysis show, not a review show. And that means that there will be spoilers. However, we're going to avoid spoilers in the first part of the show. We'll do quick thumbs up, thumbs down reviews after a synopsis, which all of that should be spoiler free. And then we'll move on to a little game called Expanding the Syllabus, which usually involve thematic spoilers, but not typically plot spoilers. And then we play some music to let you know that we've gotten down to business. And that's when all spoiler bets are off. So that's your warning and disclaimer.
And since we don't really cover television shows that often, there's a pretty good chance we'll be spoiling all three seasons of Twin Peaks in addition to the film Fire Walk With Me.
It could happen.
So
it's not necessary, but it could happen.
Yeah, it's not necessary, but I, you know, no, I don't.
You're not spoiling the return, so no. Go ahead and cut that stream off now.
Oh, are you? We're not.
We're not. No, you don't want to. You don't want to be spoiled. Okay.
Okay. Arthur wants no return spoilers, so okay, I retract enough. My statement. We will be only spoiling the original broadcast run of Twin Peaks. 90 spoilers only.
I'll allow it.
Golden Age Part 3 of television.
And we don't spoil movies on this podcast, so we won't spoil The Return.
I did finish The Return, my rewatch of The Return yesterday.
You did, so, perfect.
Yeah.
You returned to The Return?
I returned to The Return. I once again returned. I'm just on constant repeat and reloop now.
Well, I'll tell you who's not returning. Fire Walk With Me is about Laura Palmer's final days as they play out as the homecoming queen reckons with her demons and the FBI investigates a mysterious killer in the region.
Very good, very good. Yes, we meet Chester Desmond, not Agent Cooper, for quite a bit of the show, which made audiences angry. So, both of you, I assume, are virgin.
They don't know how prequels work.
I'm sure they were also mad that everything in this movie is stuff that you already learned in the run of the show.
Yes, there's no mystery revealing at all.
No, no. It is just a prequel about Laura Palmer, ultimately. I can see why people were crazy mad.
Yes, because what happened to Dale? He smashed his head in the mirror and he had Bob's reflection in there. Is Dale Bob now? What's going on? Nobody knows.
And wouldn't know for another
25 years.
Yeah. Insane.
Which is...
Respect the long game.
I do respect the long game. Yeah. So you're both virgin viewers to Fire Walk With Me. I will go to Arthur first. Mm. Do you like to Fire Walk With Me?
Actually, I do like Fire Walk With Me quite a bit. I like Twin Peaks okay. There are things about it I really enjoy. I think Twin Peaks is maybe at its strongest when it's doing its quirkiness, with all of the townspeople and you know, Big Ed. And,
you like Lucy and Andy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, all that fun goofiness that takes place and all the silliness that abounds there. And then any kind of, it leans more into the drama or the melodramatic. I don't know that it always is as effective for me. I just really kind of am fascinated by this town that has been built out in this world that's built out, and Josie and the sheriff, Harry Truman, and you know, all those fun people. And so I like Twin Peaks fine. So I wasn't sure where I was going to go with Fire Walk With Me, but I really appreciate Fire Walk With Me doubling down on sort of that stark coldness that I don't think Lynch ever is really able to get to in the original run of Twin Peaks. I think it's always kind of undercut by the sort of absurd comedy stuff that takes place. I think we see fleeting moments of it here and there, especially, even in the initial pilot, when we see the reveal of Laura Palmer, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty dark for a episodic TV show on you know, broadcast television. But I like the tonal downshift, upshift, whatever you want to call it, in Fire Walk With Me to really focus on sort of this much more stark, tragic story. And I think that works. Cheryl Lee as Laura Palmer is just an incredible performance. She's just plays it so well. She's so tragic. That character is so lived in. I think it really helps coming off of the show itself to have that sort of depth to that character already. Mm-hmm. But I think Cheryl Lee plays it well. Myra Kelly coming in as Donna is fine. I'm never really in love with Laura Flynn Boyle as Donna anyway. Like, that's not like a, you know, there are other characters I'd have been probably been upset about if they'd been recast for this.
If you replace Audrey, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That would have been probably a deal breaker, right? Laura Flynn Boyle wasn't really a big loss in my mind. I think Moira Kelly is actually probably able to play that sort of innocent naivety a little more than what we see. And then the fact that Laura's take on it is kind of after the events of this. So the things that happened to that character in this movie have already played. So I think there's some, you know, logistical ways you can look at that and the approaches to the character, you know, pre and post. And so I enjoy this though quite a bit. I really do like the, you know, this is what he does in Blue Velvet, I think, quite well. It's what he gets to do a little bit in Lost Highway as well. But it is that idea, this the kind of seedy underbelly of this town, this small town that on a paper, on a map, seems charming, seems innocent, seems pure and wholesome. But the homecoming queen is the one with the biggest secrets and the darkest, you know, demons. And I think that is so reflective of, I think, so many small town experiences. Well, yeah, surely in big cities as well, but it feels heightened in a small town because it is a small town, right? When you get into a bigger city, bigger metropolitan area, surely there are more and more, you know, per capita Laura Palmer stories. But there aren't a ton in a small town. And so it emphasizes that, I think. And so I think Lynch does that well. We'll get into an analysis thematically, what he's been doing and what he does here well, I think. And so, yeah, it may be close to the top of my Lynch picks. If I was ranking, I think it would be top three.
Wow.
For me, I really like Fire Walk With Me. I think it jettisons a lot of the fat from Twin Peaks to tell a very effective, tragic story that's very emotionally, I think, jarring. And there are a lot of moments in this, not to spoil anything, scene to scene, that are just heartbreaking to see watch play out. And so, a lot of it just comes down to Cheryl Lee.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a knockout performance, I think.
Very good, very good. What do you say, Dalton?
Oh, boy. This was confusing. I fortunately did some homework. I did not watch the television show Twin Peaks. I watched an essay on Twin Peaks, got myself up to speed on what I needed to know, and watched the film with somebody who has two people who've watched Twin Peaks. So I had them to guide me on this viewing. But I decided, no, I am committing to the prequel first. And boy, do they assume you have seen the TV show.
Yes. That's probably fair.
Wow, do they assume you've seen the show, which I agree. Totally fair. It honestly was a perfectly fine viewing experience, though, having, like, you know, viewed an essay sort of about the overarching themes and narrative gist of the first two seasons and the film itself before even watching the film. And then again, having somebody who was familiar with the show watch with me was a good grounding to have in terms of, like, okay, wait, do I need to know what this is? And yes, you do. I did not clarify with him. Chester, he's just from the movie, right? They don't really deal
he's
with...
He's only in the movie.
That's what I thought, because that murder doesn't really come up. The murder that he's investigating doesn't really come up in the show other than, like, it's referenced, right?
It's referenced, in the very first episode,
yeah.
Or the second episode, that Cooper says there's been a Teresa Banks murder, and it reminds me of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. That's kind of what I thought. All right. This is a tough watch. It does make me much more interested in Twin Peaks, especially the first half, like as far as capturing that tone of kind of oddness mixed with sort of genuine intrigue and suspense mixed with, you know, kind of it's so funny. It's really funny. I don't know what to tell you. That lady in the red dress has cracked me up.
Oh, Lil?
Lil? Whew. That's great.
She had a sour face.
She did have a sour face.
She had a sour face.
That's the only way to describe the face she had. Bowie's, that's Fire Walk With Me exclusive as well, right?
Yes.
Sort of. Okay, cool.
Yeah, he's already passed away by the time they make the return.
That's, well, and again, like.
So. I said no spoilers.
You didn't know David Bowie was dead?
Bowie's just in space, baby.
Man.
Wow.
He just went home.
So true, Arthur.
But Philip Jeffries is back.
Interesting. They recast Philip Jeffries for the return?
Sort of.
Okay. Interesting.
That all tracks.
Yeah.
It's all Mobius strip.
Yeah. I guess I don't know what to tell you.
No spoilers. I'm not going to tell you. You're gonna be delighted when you meet Philip Jeffries again, though.
Yeah. I tried to hang with it, and I think I did an okay job. So what are we ultimately left with in this? Something that is not as interesting as it probably was in the 90s, unfortunately. Now, that said, I think this is, especially in the wake of Silence of the Lambs, and I think in the, we kind of talked around this when we first started recording, as a Maggie Mayfish two-parter was mm-hmm. the Twin Peaks essay I took in to kind of ground myself in this world. And I thought it was very interesting to sort of pair this film with the wake of the massive success of Silence of the Lambs. I think now we've sort of had more stories that are critical of sort of the Dead Girl Town narrative, whether it's, you know, sort of the jumping off point with something like Twin Peaks or sort of this pastiche culmination in True Detective, all four seasons of True Detective, you could say. So I think it's really interesting to see this story of the murdered woman, the murdered young girl, or murdered young woman. And instead of focusing on, you know, the investigation, the intrigue, the aftermath, it is all about sort of tracking. I mean, it is, you know, Fruitvale Station in some ways, instead of, you know, looking at the way the police state criminalizes black bodies. It is the way, like, patriarchal family structures take advantage of the women that are trapped within them. Mm-hmm. It's heavy stuff. When it starts being heavy stuff, you know, for the first half, it is, you know, Twin Peaks with a few more F words, ultimately, right? That's sort of the gist that I got. I was like, well, this seems like the three episodes of Twin Peaks I've seen. tonally speaking, mm-hmm. until we really sort of get into the minutia of, you know, Laura Palmer's double life and sort of the mysteries she unearths to put her on a collision course with her fate. It's really interesting. Just again, like seeing her unravel this mystery. Cause again, there is still a mystery component in this, right? It's just Laura's the detective character. Yes. Ultimately. So it's that detective mystery is still there, but I'm so much more interested in just like the living life with Laura Palmer for a week is really interesting. It's just tough, man. It's just like of the movies we've watched,
she has a bad time.
Yeah. The last 40 minutes of this is a real endurance test. And if you don't have the grounding of the show or the knowledge from the show, of like, oh, I know what scene's about to happen because of what we learn in the run of the show. Like, it is, you're just like, ooh, okay, you're really up against it for the last stretch of this movie. And it does have like a really kind of powerful and resonant and interesting ending that I'm sure we will try to unpack. This is, I'd not say the most mixed, because I think Dune is barely a success. So I won't say that this is the least successful for me, but I definitely like it the least of the successful films that we've watched, I guess is what I would say. I like it more than Dune. I think it is a more unequivocal success than Dino De Laurentiis's, David Lynch's, Frank Herbert's Dune.
Well, that's safe ground to be on, I think, in general.
Right. And I don't dislike this at all. I'm just like, boy, this is a one-timer for me. And even after I finish watching Twin Peaks, I don't think I need to revisit Fire Walk With Me for quite some time.
I think you might, well, you may or may not want to, because I think a lot of the code of the return is in Fire Walk With Me, much more so than even the TV show.
Interesting.
So, but, you know, more on that off mic probably, since we're not going to spoil the return. What I would say in review of Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me is I like it very, very much. I don't know where it would be in my, you know, official David Lynch power rankings as we are sort of making, you know.
We need the clickbait. You won't believe what number four is.
Number four is Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. What? That would be the confusing pick, right?
Spectacles, listicles, wallet, watch. Is that anything?
Yes. Okay. Mm. That is definitely something.
Okay, sorry.
I'm not sure what it is, but it is definitely something. I think it's Angelo Badalamenti's best score of any of the Lynch stuff.
Can I tell you guys, I thought you were saying Angela this whole month.
Oh, Angelo.
It's Angelo. Mm-hmm. For me to finally notice it's Angelo on Fire Walk With Me, it was like a real like head-scratching moment. I was like, oh. Oh, okay. Well, I guess it doesn't make that big of a difference, but it does change a little bit of the mental math I was doing.
Sure.
But no, Badalamenti's score.
I think it's my favorite score from him.
His work has been spectacular. I mean, I can see why Lynch like always wanted to collaborate with him. It's crazy.
Well, and expands and adapts. You know, there's some existing Twin Peaks music from the TV show, which is great. Mm-hmm. I own that soundtrack and listen to it sometimes when driving. But I think really it. It's jazzier and that sort of rockabilly kind of thing that it's got going for it, alongside just much more, there's a lot more heart, I think, in the string section and the synth sections for those sort of plaintive themes that play throughout. And so I think it is my favorite Badalamenti effort altogether through this. I mean, I really, really enjoy The Return as well, but I think The Return success mostly is because of soundtrack, which is a slightly different beast than scoring there. And I really love Moira Kelly. I think she's a better Donna than Donna, which is too bad. I mean, I like the old Donna too. I like both Donnas, but I do think Moira Kelly brings a bit more innocence to the role that was sort of missing from that. And I think it's a really kind of impossible task that he pulls off, which is, what do you do with a story in which you already know who the killer is? So you make it a story about the murder victim finding out who's going to murder her.
Yeah,
that's what you do.
It's a much more succinct way to talk about like what I was trying to talk around. But yeah, I guess we it's not really a spoiler for the film if you're aware of what Twin Peaks is.
Yeah,
I guess.
In Twin Peaks, the killer's revealed. We're not giving that name right now.
Yeah,
you know, so we'll avoid that in this section. But then what happens is Laura discovers who her killer is.
Yeah.
You know, and so there is that sort of noirish mm-hmm. kind of investigation, that seedy underbelly there. It is a bit more... I'll tell you what, I think some of those Roadhouse scenes play a little too long.
Yeah, they really do.
The loud and audible dialogue of them, I think, is fun.
Yes, I think that's cool.
But I think it's too much. And they could have been a little bit tighter. Having seen the missing pieces as well, I think they could have had more silly. Because there was more silly that was shot. Mm-hmm. And I think that would have been tonally a good choice for it. But
the missing pieces is a full additional 90 minutes, right? Yeah. And some of those are like just extended scenes of scenes that are in the original.
So, for instance, when the mean sheriff from the Oregon town, what's the name of the Oregon town? I just lost it out of my
head. Deer Creek? Deer Valley?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Deer something. Valley. Deer something.
But when he says, you're not taking... Deer Meadow, he says, you're not taking that body out of here.
Yeah.
And he's already, we've already seen the picture of him bending the steel. We actually see a scene of him bending the steel cables and going to a dookaroo with Chris Isaac, which is very, very fun.
Silly.
And, I mean, it goes as you might expect it, being a Cooper kind of stand-in for that. And so I think some of that additional just kind of bits of business, the movie lacks not having had it. You know, is what I would say. However, I think it's really, really compelling. If it is a meditation on the violence men do to women, and if it is a story that is trying to shine a light on the way we've been habituated to telling these kinds of stories, I think it's really, really effective for that without getting too deep into the weeds of analysis there. That, and I don't know whose director of photography is, but they are brilliant with lights, just lighting every scene. When they choose a gel, they choose the right gel and the gel combinations of this blue and that red, or when they're using more standard kind of light, they know when to use soft light, when to use hard light. The name is Ronald Victor Garcia. Just nails it all the way through. And very, very, very impressed with his work there, directing the lighting for the photography. So
mostly a TV cinematographer.
Well, crushed it.
Yeah.
Crushed it. So there you go, dear listener. Our thoughts are generally pro, with some caveats regarding this film. We're going to move on to the next part of our show, which is called Expanding the Syllabus. And Arthur's going to tell you what that's all about.
Expanding the Syllabus is a thought experiment wherein we, the hosts, assemble an academic course or module within a course based around the assigned viewing for the week and adjacent text from books and articles to tangentially related films and stories.
That is correct. Do you have a syllabus prepared, my friend?
Yeah, I do. I was thinking about murder in a small town kind of stories, and not necessarily just murder in a small town, but crime, investigations in a small town, really focusing on that idea. Some of these we don't see any out-and-out murder. We see some attempted, we hear of some. But I think I want to start with Alfred Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, the story of Charlie and Uncle Charlie, as they are close family friends, or close family members, I should say. Charlie begins to realize that maybe Uncle Charlie's not quite who she thought he was, and might be a killer. And it really is Hitchcock's, you know, he notably calls it his first real American film, as he begins to investigate sort of, I think thematically something we'll see him come back to again, especially in like Psycho. But this idea that, the small town's not quite as innocent as one might think, and people have dark secrets, even if we don't want them to, or find that hard to accept, it does exist. And I think that pairs very well here with, Fire Walk With Me. And from there, we're going to take a look at Robert Mitchum in The Night of the Hunter, another sort of rural setting wherein Robert Mitchum's character shows up, does some murder, and then terrorizes children, as Robert Mitchum is wont to do.
That's his MO.
That's not even the movie. That's just Robert Mitchum. What a set. I'm just kidding. I don't know if those kids were tortured by Robert Mitchum or not.
I assume they were.
Yeah. Okay, apparently he was a kind of a curmudgeon.
Well, there we go. It's unanimous. Robert Mitchum, terrorizer of children.
you heard it here first, kids.
Rest in peace. More clickbait. But again, Night of the Hunter, I think thematically is at a time dealing with something You know, we're still a ways out from the idea of, you know, serial killers and things like that. Mm-hmm. But this is, again, I think just like Hitchcock, is seeing something under the water, which is, you know, symbolically realized in that film, I think.
Yeah.
From there, we're going to take a look at In the Heat of the Night. Small town, companies, big money, racism, all the recipe ingredients you need to cook up a hard-boiled detective story where you can't trust anybody, you don't know who's on the up and up, and things could go awry for our protagonist at any point. From there, we're going to take a look at... I could have picked any number of Coen brother movies, but I'm going adjacent to that with A Simple Plan.
Nice.
Because I like the way all of the people are sort of intertwined into this story of dumb decision after dumb decision that gets made. And I think it's just a hyper effective film. I think it's super smart while it plays with a lot of those Coen ideas. It's just a movie of its own, I think, as well, and is very effective in investigating people and circumstance and the universe's role in all of that as well, and how that factors into the way we do dumb stuff when big decisions happen to fall in our lap.
If the three of us found that money, it wouldn't have gone down like that. That's all I'm saying.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I bet.
That's all I'm saying.
Hopefully we never find out. From there, we're actually going to jump across the globe. We're going to go to Korea. We're going to take a look at Bong Joon-ho's Memories of a Murder.
Sure.
Just a great criminal investigation with maybe one of the great endings of cinema. Just powerful, magnetic film. Paves, I think, it was a great debt to Seven, but paves a through line for something I think like True Detective as well. And so Bong is just killing it over there. A fascinating story of a small town kind of crime taking place. And then we're going to bring it back to the rural Ozarks, and we're going to finish out with Winter's Bone.
Nice.
With Jennifer Lawrence making her sort of name for herself, big debut there. And just examining the sort of mafia-esque crime syndicate stuff that goes on in rural drug-laden communities where meth and crack and cocaine are sort of rampant, and the impact that has on the people, the economy, and the relationships there. And so I think that it is a nice heir to something like Twin Peaks and Fire Walk with Me, and investigating these sorts of places that we typically don't turn dark and gothic, and it troubles that quite a bit, I think.
Very cool, very cool. Thank you very much for that syllabus, Arthur Gordon. Mr. Dalton Stewart, do you have a syllabus prepared as well?
I do. I like that syllabus a lot, though.
Yeah.
I'm really thinking
I'd watch
it.
All that.
Yeah. I'm just kind of thinking about, like, how sort of the wake of Twin Peaks after leads to things like Winter's Bone, like Ozarks, like just sort of this making non-noir settings more noir from the 90s onward, I think is really cool. So I was kind of thinking about modern media, our IP-driven businesses, and I was like, well, why not take a little look at like maybe a module within a new media class or sort of metatextual narratives class. Let's do the film TV show sequel. Or at the very least, the film TV show continuation, right?
Sure.
It's a pretty wide catalog at this point, really. You know, you got your Downton Abbeys, your Bigger Longers Uncuts. I mean, there are a lot of these. I can name a couple, but obviously what we're really more interested in is sort of like the nature of TV and film, how those businesses are related to each other and how they're separate from each other, and what sort of the pipeline from like what kind of TV show gets a movie, how long afterwards, when in the run, like all of these questions. So again, we'll probably look at the X-File films and the right. X-Files. Of course, I already mentioned the South Park film, Firefly and Serenity. Take a look. I think that's sort of kind of one of the great examples of just like the fan demand leading to the film, even though the commercial prospects were not great and it proved to be a bust. But again, an interesting one. Netflix, you know, having such a hit, big hit in a show that wasn't theirs, and their Breaking Bad viewership leading to them partnering with, you know, the team behind Breaking Bad to, yes, bring us the Netflix film El Camino. Very fascinating that Netflix has the rights to El Camino and AMC has the rights to Breaking Bad. I'm sure that'll come to a head at some point, and El Camino will end up on AMC just like all those Marvel shows ended up on Disney Plus. Speaking of Disney Plus, I think we'll take a little look at the show Obi-Wan and maybe the show Loki. I don't know. A lot of those shows are dog shit. I don't know what to tell you. Sorry. I don't mean to be rude, but I think even the MCU fans know.
I liked Obi-Wan.
I like Obi-Wan and Loki, too. Yeah. I think a lot of
the other ones.
Yes. Okay. Right.
Sorry. I thought of those that you named.
Yes.
No, sorry.
I think there are also some Obi-Wan haters, and I think there's plenty of stuff in Obi-Wan that doesn't work and is kind of like, oh, my God. And plenty of stuff that does work. But again, I think they are interesting, especially looking at the history of Lucasfilm and the history of Marvel Comics and how they come to be Disney properties, how those unique film franchises lead to unique, you know, premium, over-the-top subscription service media content, mm-hmm. right? It's weird. It's weird, and it stretches our definitions of what is TV and what is film, and that's why I think Fire Walk With Me and The Return and Twin Peaks are very useful. Obviously, we've had a lot of fun at Dustin's expense talking about how Cahiers du Cinema and somebody else, I can't even remember which publication, but another publication.
Sight and Sound.
Was it Sight and Sound? Okay. Some publications decided to insist that The Return was a film. That's obviously their right to do. And we can have, maybe that's what the final project is the final paper, is you have to make your case on, like, what is a TV show, what is a film, and where do the two begin and end, and where do they meet? Maybe we'll have that conversation as we get into business time. I don't know, maybe not. I have some other TV show movies here, but, you know, Veronica Mars, Simpsons, Wrath of Khan. You've heard of a TV
show. It's
about
the same.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You get the idea.
Well, there's also the reverse polarity, right? Where the movie becomes a TV show.
Absolutely.
And
name one.
Casablanca.
One more.
Clerks.
MASH? Is MASH, MASH reverse too?
Yes.
Yeah. MASH is...
Clerks.
Clerks the animated series,
baby.
Yep. Yep.
Casablanca made a TV show?
Yep.
What was it called?
Casablanca.
When was it?
Scatman Carruthers was... Sam. That's all I remember. And Hector Alonziato was Rick. Not Rick. Louie.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think it only ran a season.
Huh.
It was kind of a failure.
So you're right. 80s or 90s?
I think it's 80s.
There's a few of these. There's not as many.
Late 70s, 80s.
I'm trying to... I didn't look up any, and I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I wish I had. Because, yeah, I mean, that's obviously also... Oh, Brady Bunch...
Sure, yeah.
But that's sort of a different thing, but, you know, worth looking at, right?
Well, Brady Bunch is TV show to movie. We're
that's
doing
right.
movies
Sorry.
That became TV
I
shows.
I was just thinking of the adaptation being such a satire and send-up of the source material. That's sort of why it came back to my mind. But, yeah, what are other movies that went TV mode?
I mean, Ghostbusters.
Sure, there's a ton
cartoon,
of cartoon.
Yeah, animated.
Yeah. There was a Godzilla 99 cartoon, like Saturday morning cartoon spinoff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you remember
Men in Black?
There?
I mean, a lot of those Black shows had animated spinoffs. Yep. All those Disney movies, Aladdin, and et cetera.
And I would say, surely those sort of great westerns. There's got to be some. I mean, there's so much Western TV that certainly they tried to make.
They did a Bonanza prequel series called Ponderosa in like 2008
That's
or 7. Yeah. I watched part of it. Yeah.
Well, we're getting those two Gotham shows after the Batman.
That's true. Right?
So, yeah. I mean, that's the thing.
So yeah, and you know, this is kind of adjacent, but you know, direct to DVD movies, you know, Gotham Knights to you know, and the Animatrix, sort of these anime movies to promote the larger property.
Mm-hmm.
All of this is relevant to this sort of new media, intertextual media conversation for sure. How would you teach?
Irrelevant is the fact that, did you know that there's a Sunset Boulevard musical?
What?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Cool.
I'm there for it.
Also, I told Sells this. Did you know there's a Lost Highway opera?
I did know about that. I did see that in my research last week. That rocks, right?
I want to see
that. I can't believe we didn't talk about it last week, but yes, I did see this.
Yeah, presumably it rocks.
Yeah, I have to imagine.
Rammstein.
Dustin, how would you, deep fan of Twin Peaks that you are, teach the film Fire Walk With Me?
How about Twin Peaks the class?
Yeah.
Just like I mean, did do in the class.
Let's do the class.
Yeah, I think you could.
And so you've got all the source material. I think you do the book of collected essays called She's Full of Secrets. And then there's a great book also out about the fandom and the formation of fandoms. Because it's pretty early in sort of the... I mean, there are Trekkies and Trek conventions. Mm-hmm. But this is the sort of... The 90s begins this sort of interesting moment where we... balkanize our fandoms in kind of interesting ways. And so an examination specifically of that particular fandom there, we would read Todd McGowan's The Impossible David Lynch, sort of getting our minds around his style. Mm-hmm. Selections from several of his films I think would also be part of the selection as well. And then I'd probably do a little TV history on top of just a little bit of watching some Columbo episodes, a little bit of Murder, She Wrote, and the TV soap opera Dallas and Dynasty.
Sure.
And I think that would be the bones of what we would do for that as a class.
Do you talk about the children of Twin Peaks? You know, you're obviously mentioned X-Files. Buffy.
Buffy
moved
sure.
to TV show. Duh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Can't believe we didn't
hit
on that.
That's the biggie on the eye chart.
Obviously.
How did we miss that?
Yeah, seriously. But anyway, like, those shows are so, like, in the wake of not only, like, how self-referential Twin Peaks is as a TV show, but also sort of its tone, its serialization especially. I mean, yeah, like, is that something this class is going to get into maybe?
We might even flash a little forward and talk about Lost, I think, which seems to be the real kind of mystery is the point descendant,
mm-hmm.
right? There is a certain obscurantist kind of twist within the world of the X-Files, because you can't ever figure out what's going on mm-hmm. with what the cigarette smoking man's thing is.
I hope he's in this one.
but there's a little bit of that, but the monster, I mean, it's got enough of those little monsters of the week pieces that they sort of do have kind of a traditional set of closure. Mm-hmm. Lost does sort of like intentionally frustrate in a way that's, I think, similar to the Twin Peaks universe. And so that might be probably the closest descendant.
It has lots of fans that hate it, too, which is sort of, I feel like,
crucial. Lost fans hate Twin Peaks?
Oh, no, Lost fans hate Lost.
Yeah. Real? Why are they Lost fans, then?
Ending.
I don't understand people.
It's like all the Game of Thrones fans who hate Game of Thrones now.
Oh, because it didn't end the way they wanted it to?
Well, I mean, even if that's how you wanted it to end, pretty... haphazard last two seasons. I think we can all agree. Yeah.
I stopped watching.
You're not missing anything. Yeah. It's fine. I'm not as mad about the end. I think the ending is telegraphed, but also is like sloppy.
It is telegraphed.
All get out big time
from pretty early.
Yeah. Oh yeah. They let you know where they're going.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that it's like, doesn't make it more dramatically satisfying.
So
fans love to hate the thing that they love. Are you kidding me? That's part of the relationship.
I don't understand those people. I guess I've seen this thing. You know, I mean, Star Wars fans hating the new Star Wars or hating the prequels or whatever. It's something I'm familiar
MCU
with.
MCU fans hating Phase 4.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just once a thing reaches critical mass, like that's part of the ephemera of it.
Yeah,
it's like arguing about what it should or should not be.
Which is why the fandom book would be, I think, a lot of our discussion. You know, because there are Twin Peaks conventions, and there mm-hmm. are, you know, there's, I mean, the whole world of Twin Peaks memes themselves mm-hmm. is its own kind of thing.
Sure.
Be a good time, I think.
I love it.
So,
are there any movies that you feel like are essential to pair with Fire Walk With Me, or to pair with like Twin Peaks as a, I know obviously you mentioned the kind of the TV shows and the antecedents and the successors.
Like, we might pick up some of the Lynch stuff.
Sure.
I mean, obviously the Gordon Cole connection to Sunset Boulevard itself, I think, is probably important to pick up. Probably watch The Wizard of Oz,
mm-hmm.
Just because of its sort of textiness with the world of Twin Peaks and the world of David Lynch in general. But I mean, I'd probably just stick mostly to the source material,
okay.
you know, primary text. But I definitely Sunset Boulevard would definitely have to be one of them.
Copy that.
Yeah. Okay. Because there's a character, Gordon Cole, mm-hmm. in that as well, that wants to borrow Norma Desmond's car. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, obviously the name of David Lynch's character, the director of the FBI, mm-hmm. Gordon Cole. So, all right. Well, I think your syllabus has got much longer, dear listener. I believe now it's time we get down to business.
Bring me your film analysis.
Sorry.
Leland Palmer killed Aura Palmer. Okay.
Yeah, so we can get that out of the way. And no, it's not because he was possessed by Bob. Bob's a metaphor. I mean, yes, it's because he was possessed by Bob, but Bob is also a metaphor. Two things can be true.
There's the movie level, and then there's the meta level.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yes, on the movie level, he's possessed by a demonic interdimensional being of some sort, right?
At the meta level, though, Bob sort of represents, like, the darkness that lurks within the hearts of all of us, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's sort of the big E on the eye chart.
And some disassociation, right, as a victim and things.
Well, yeah, totally. Well, as a perpetrator, disassociation, how you distance yourself is not me that's acting. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the real me is the good me. You know, the father knows best.
But she also
me.
Sees Bob as well, exactly. Which would mean she's disassociating.
Yeah, totally. At a level. It's happening for both of them. Yeah. That's kind of an interesting thing to hit on in Firewalk with Me is sort of, obviously this film doesn't have like, this is not a movie about generating empathy for Leland Palmer, but it does also sort of see Leland as a victim of larger systems and in a way. I mean, obviously, he does not want you to root for him. But
right, but he is a prisoner of his circumstances.
In some ways. But much more interesting is just sort of like, again, it's so obvious now because we've been having different conversations for the last 30 years, but in the era of kids on milk cartons, this idea of, you know, the parental abuser is not a common talking point and is not something we're really discussing as a society.
Oh, in the 80s and 90s?
Yeah.
No, it's always the stranger danger. It's always scary outsider that looks like Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or the person behind the Winkies.
Yeah.
Which
is gotten into at great length in the essay that Dustin and I both mentioned, the Maggie Mayfish Twin Peaks essay, kind of gets into like both where Twin Peaks fits into like the culture of the 80s and 90s, like as a murder show, where it fits into the culture of the 80s and 90s, and then of course like how the history of like murder media reacts to Twin Peaks afterwards. But yeah, it is so much a narrative of stranger danger, and we're not really talking about, I mean, obviously now true crime podcasts, TV shows based on those true crime podcasts, it's all about like the weirdo who insinuates himself into your family, either because he's marrying in or because he was always there or whatever the case. You have so many very widely known stories of sort of family annihilators, family predators, you know, various con artists and so forth. I mean, this is the danger is in the home, and we all know that now.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's less of a sort of talking point back then. So it does sort of make it, again, for me watching it now, it seems less essential. But also, if I can kind of take a step back and put myself in more of a 90s headspace, I'm like, oh, I can see how this really
super cutting edge.
Yeah. In some ways, it is very provocative.
Right.
And not just like, because of the content.
And the other big provocation of the entirety of the Twin Peaks universe, and again, the choice to go back to Laura Palmer's story is itself, and Maggie Mayfish sort of points out some of this to a less extent than the Twin Perfect commentator does, but both of them, I think, rightly see that we need to see the humanity of the victims rather than these sort of disposable, you know, again, think about a Murder, She Wrote or a Columbo episode. You're like, we have a dead body in a refrigerator, now it's all about finding the killer. Mm-hmm. All right. And then you find the killer, very last scene of the last episode, and then return to normal. And then we have a new killer next week. And the spending the time with the humanizing the characters, Maggie Mayfish does this great job, as we saw in that essay, of comparing the autopsy scenes of Teresa Banks to the autopsy of the girl found in the river. The Vicks vapor rub under the nose scene of Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
Comparing those two scenes and how it's so, you know, she's so fragmented and so depersonalized and she becomes a hulking, you know, odoriferous thing rather than a person. And the way the camera rests on Teresa Banks's face. And so her fundamental humanity gets reaffirmed there. And having Laura Palmer, our murder victim, again, the intention of the TV series being to never solve it and spend this time looking at the aftermath of people experiencing that loss, to come back and say, now we're going to show you the backstory of her last week on Earth, is once again going back. It's like, this is about the victim. This is about the person. This is about a human being that was alive and now is not. And I still find just that to be compelling and pretty revolutionary, because I mean, we live in a time right now of this true crime obsession, which although they spend a lot of time talking about what dirtbags it seems like, I feel like there's a lot of lampshading. Hey, we're not glorifying this particular killer because they're a dirtbag, but we spend all the time just talking about all their dirtbaggery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
unpacking the psychology of terrible people or the psychology of failed police institutions.
And then at the end of it, you know, you sort of once again recite the names, mm-hmm. you know, of the victims. But again, that still feels trite to me. I still don't think someone's quite as lovingly and sensitively approached the topic of sort of murder entertainment in a way that has, again, really personalized the victim as successfully as Lynch has done in Twin Peaks. I mean, I'm willing to hear another one. But
I thought this most recent sort of spinoff or however you want to categorize them continuing True Detective without the, you know, the
which I haven't
series
seen,
originator.
In fairness.
Yeah, they do a pretty good job of making the new case and the cold case be about each other and about not the new victims because they're male scientists and the show is not as interested in them as the backstory of sort of this murdered Alaska Native woman. So it's but it's still not even close though. Scratches the surface of that for sure. But it's we don't get a week in the life of this woman. Like, and then that's, you know, obviously they don't have a movie, but they had a 6-episode TV show.
You could do some flashbacks, right?
And they do a little bit.
See some photos, but yeah.
Did you watch the new True Detective?
I need to finish it. I think I got to 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's like maybe slightly more that you haven't seen.
Okay.
But even what we do get becomes about like solving the murder happened, or mystery mm-hmm. what happened to her more than like characterizing her as a human being. There is like one like really cool cold open about her and like what she was about and what her life was like. But yeah, that's the only one I can think of. Yeah. What are other... I mean, gosh, I couldn't even tell you the name of the first victim in True Detective. I mean,
sure.
to kind of...
No.
She has a good name, but I can think of Reggie Ledoux, which is like a red herring suspect. Or no, maybe he's the guy that did it. It's been a long time since I watched True Detective.
Point being. Yeah.
I can tell you a suspect's name, but I can't tell you. Yeah. Because of the repetition of that. But she's... Oh, it's going to come to me halfway through this, I'm sure. Anyway. Yeah. I think it is... pretty profound what they do. I'm trying to think of anything that comes close, and you know, maybe we will as we talk about it, but it's pretty... I mean, the only other thing that I can think of that is like this is the already mentioned Fruitvale Station, which I think is a really... obviously it is much
the whole time with the victim until,
and it's much more grounded in the real world and our reality mm-hmm. than Twin Peaks is, obviously, but it is very much about like putting a human face on the victim of systemic violence, right? And taking one person's story and showing how it connects to a larger pattern within our society. I'm wondering what you could pair with those two to build out a class, because that's kind of its whole own interesting thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As far as just media that deals with the violence we do to each other, but that is so centered on putting a name and a person to the victims of violence. I can't think of a movie that spends that much time on saying like, we are going to tell you everything about who this person was and is, and then we are going to make you watch as we snuff their light out. There are not a lot of movies that do that. And it mm-hmm. is tough to sit through. I truly can't think of another film other than those two. That is sort of like, that is the thesis statement of the movie. And I get why.
Which is wild to me, right?
It's wild that that's the case. Yeah, I get why though, right? Because it is tough to put an audience mm-hmm. through, and it is a lot to ask.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, why the true crime genre wouldn't be as lucrative or successful if it focused on the victim.
Yeah,
I think most people just get real sad real quick and are, you know,
but moving on. Yeah,
yeah. Rather than, I mean, there's the intrigue of how could the person do this, and mm-hmm. you know, how did they get that many bodies in their crawl space?
Right. Get them dead by the commercial break, and then it'll be the manhunt, or it'll be the... Yeah.
There's that. Yeah, when you spend 2 hours here, you know, however many episodes in a podcast with a victim, mm-hmm. right? I mean, and you get to know them and identify with them, and then...
I guess like Dirty John, The Shrink Next Door. Mm-hmm. These are... I didn't see That's funny. Listen to the podcast, Dirty John. Didn't watch the show. Watched the show, Shrink Next Door. Didn't listen to the podcast. So that's my frame of reference.
Zachary plays in this place a lot.
Sure. Okay. That's a good example. A film that I need to catch up with, but I'm aware of what it is enough to know why you'd reference it. Yeah. I was just, the shows sl/ podcasts I referenced are very much about like.
Well, I was thinking S-Town. I don't know if you listened to
S-Town. Okay. I did.
S-Town's a good example. Yeah.
Of trying to foreground the person who is at the center of intrigue.
Yeah.
Even though there's not really murder in S-Town.
Yeah.
They do befall tragedy, though. Yes. Tragedy befalls them.
Yeah. But again, like, I think that's a good example. So, there definitely is media that is about centering, you know, the people who are taken advantage of or hurt or killed by our systems, by individuals thriving because of systems. But it is not. You can't really point to it as a, you know, a cottage industry, right?
I mean, you know, thinking about, I mean, Holocaust films are really the one place where I think we deal with this, right?
Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, by the nature of Schindler's List.
Mm-hmm. But even then, Schindler's List, we focus on one of the Germans.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the star is Liam Neeson's character.
Showa.
Yeah.
So. I guess that what you're, I mean,
but that's, I think, the closest part we get to it.
Go get a ton of adaptations.
Son of Saul would be,
I was just thinking, we don't get a ton of adaptations of Anne Frank other than stage adaptation. I know there's the famous stage adaptation, but we don't have a ton of movies about that story, which probably for the best in some ways.
There's one, what's it called? Gray Zone? It was an HBO series, and it's got, I can't remember who was in it, but it's very much set in the camps and what's taking place.
About living there. And
yeah, the Sonderkommandos and the, you know, the prisoners who would police the other prisoners for a few benefits until their usefulness ran out sort of stuff.
I mean, this is sort of not going to talk about a terribly titled John Lennon song, but if we look at the film cast and sort of think about racial caste systems and the way those crimes, I'm just thinking about the film cast or origin.
I thought
the
about book it earlier. Cast,
the film origin. Yeah. I think it's kind of related to what we're talking about.
I think so.
Yeah. If we sort of accept patriarchy and white supremacy as systems that interlink to one another, like there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know that we have, I'd be interested to see sort of like,
I mean, studios know it's going to be a downer, right?
Yeah.
They're going to put that movie out.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing.
It's crazy that this movie got made.
Truly.
And that there was, you know, another hour and a half of material on the cutting room floor to cut together. Like, wild that they found this movie in the edit, to me.
Yeah.
I truly can't even imagine what the shooting script looked like if there's four hours of filmed material. Yeah.
I think narratively, one thing that's really interesting about this film that Lynch is, I think, able to overcome is the idea of in Twin Peaks, we, you know, Laura is dead to begin the series. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the inciting thing that gets the whole thing going. And as we move through that series, we begin to find out information about Laura and the things that, like, she was struggling with, her demons and drug use and working at the, as a sex worker and things like this. And I think there's a thing that happens for viewers or audiences, and it could be here, it could be in a horror film, it could be wherever, but oftentimes when we're given this sort of context, we let our imagination fill in the gaps, which can make things much darker. You know, there's a way in which it is mitigated by our experience, what we can imagine about this thing that's happening. And so we have an idea that Laura had a kind of a rough time, was in probably way too deep in these different scenarios. So I think one of the big struggles Lynch has to do now is go in and how can I develop this so that it would match maybe what people are thinking she has gone through.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think narratively that's a really interesting battle to have to do. Right. I mean, and again, not something you see very often in media, right. To have to now go back in and fill in the blanks, unless it is maybe some kind of like hotshot at prequel or, I mean, Rogue One or something like that.
Rings of Power.
Yeah.
Becomes a snake eating its own tail, and so-and-so is so-and-so's uncle or whatever.
Yeah. I think that initial, those first few episodes are so kind of, not dependent, but there's a really heavy focus on the audience has to try to understand who Laura is as best they can with the information that Dale is gathering. And so for Lynch, I think to go in and develop that and fill in those blanks, I think it is a real challenge to be able, like, okay, can I make this as tragic as audiences maybe thought it was? Is it going to be too tragic? Is it not tragic? And, you know, what's that line? I think narratively that's an interesting place to go.
Do we get many Cheryl Lee flashbacks in the series Twin Peaks, or is she just a beautiful corpse? Is that sort of a thing?
Not much.
Yeah. I mean, we get pictures of her, and then her cousin shows up.
Yeah, there's some video of her at a picnic.
Yeah, with
Donna James. James doing the photography. Yeah.
Well, if nothing else, you have to give credit where it's due in that, like...
But even that's a more serene sort of moment, right?
They built an entire movie around this performance. You know, that's obviously Lynch has worked with Shirley on other stuff, but that is like really trusting your actor to be like, hey, I know I didn't give you anything to do when I cast you, but now here's a whole movie where you're the star.
Well, she does play her own doppelganger, so she does play.
Okay,
there's a cousin that looks just Maddie. Like Laura.
Okay, of course,
but with dark hair.
Of course,
Laura does have the Red Room sequences as well.
Sure. Yeah. I didn't think about that. So, okay, he's worked with her enough to know that she can, you know, carry a film. But, like, that's not a job you know you're going to get, I guess, is the other point I was kind of making. Like, that's awesome. I mean, it's very cool to be like, all right, I'm going to... They want more Twin Peaks, but they won't let me make the show. What do I do? We're going to write a movie about Laura Palmer. And Cheryl Lee is going to have a star vehicle. Kind of... A very cool take on how to turn this particular show into a movie, I think.
And again, just the out-and-out refusal to make a sequel.
Yeah.
I mean, just bananas.
Yeah. I'll do that in 25 years. When they can watch it on their phone.
I guess we need to talk a little bit, you know, if you're listening this far in and you've watched Firewalk with Me, you might be confused, dear listener, as to what exactly Laura is doing at the end when she allows herself rather than Ronette to be murdered and all of that kind of stuff going on there. Bob is trying to possess her. She's going to be the next Bob. This is the end movie story. And then we'll do the meta thing, I guess. Mm. But just for, you know, a little primer of what the way I understand it, and again, correct me if other theories or whatever. But Bob wants to possess Laura, and Laura is going to be the next sort of ongoing killer, right? Mike and Bob had a partnership at one point, and Mike cut his arm off because it has this sort of shared tattoo with Bob to do that murder. And so the arm is kind of operating independently of that kind of understanding of the world. And so if she puts on the ring, that's how Bob is stealing the pain and suffering that was going to the two of them into the Red Room. So by putting on the ring, she becomes a victim rather than a surrogate.
Okay.
Is the choice that she's making. And so she chooses to be a victim rather than being overcome and possessed by the darkness is the end movie thing. Does that track with everybody else?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. Again, I don't know how confusing it is, but people oftentimes leave this particular of David Lynch's movies, I think more so than even Lost Highway sometimes, going, what? And not knowing what to do with it. The TV side of it, the sort of meta side of it, is that she agrees to be the victim of a TV show that might get us off a diet of pain and suffering as audience members, as viewers, and that she is part of a work to redeem television from the sort of murder of the day, murder of the week kind of thing. And so that's the angelic vision that she's choosing to be rather than letting Ronette die. And being just another victim of the day.
Well, that's an interesting meta reading. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, for me, that's definitely how... I'm not thinking about, like, her as, you know, the surrogate lamb of... Or not the sacrificial lamb of redeeming television, but just thinking about her seeing herself as an angel in the Red Room and being like, okay, I got to die, like, on my own terms. You know, feeling like I was a good person and like I did the right things, not, you know, being a vessel for pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's definitely what the angel vision with her and Coop would lead me to believe, right?
Yeah.
That's, you know, I think that's pretty right there, even if we're not accepting the angel as a metaphor for, you know, personifying, you know, the pain that people do to women on television. That there's still like something interesting there, even if we don't zoom out and try to make it about media writ large.
Mm-hmm.
It is very funny that they try to find something for Kyle MacLachlan to do in this film.
Mm, yeah.
By giving him a couple of...
Well, he didn't want to do much. He was worried about being typecast. Mm-hmm.
That's funny. That makes sense. But it's just interesting. I mean, he's kind of in the Red Room wraparound to be like, yes, he's in the room, she's in the room, we're back to the end of the show, Twin Peaks. And then obviously he's in the sort of the...
The Philadelphia office.
The prequel stuff, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just kind of... No. And I like that. I like that he's, you know, the movie doesn't need him. It's, you got to kind of reference Coop, which totally makes sense to me, but I'm glad that we
don't. Because the movie's about Laura.
Totally.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, I guess that's, the whole time I was watching this, I was kind of struggling to be like, what is the larger, like, read on this? Like, what are we even going to unpack with this film? Because other than sort of kind of this interesting thing you've just laid out about the meta TV read, all that really is there is a story that humanizes the victims of masculine violence, like, more than our stories typically, especially because men tell a lot of these stories.
Sure.
We're going to humanize this character more than we probably ever would otherwise. And I think that's valuable. I think it's a very good story. And again, Shirley is incredible, and Lynch, like, writes a real role for her. But I was trying to think, like, other than that, and then again, other than sort of examining the violence that comes from within inside the home, what are we left with to unpack about Fire Walk With Me? You know, being a homecoming queen in a small town is going to want you to make you want to seek out a certain amount of danger, maybe. I mean, there's sure, I guess. Mm-hmm. I kind of get this kind of larger point about the way teens, like, self-destruct.
Right.
You know, but I think that's well observed. But I don't know. It kind of shockingly is a little thin analytically, I guess, is maybe the thing I'm
without
bumping
the self-reflexive bit. Yeah.
I'm kind of bumping up against that, which is, you know, not necessarily, I guess it's because it's part of the Twin Peaks universe, I guess that self-reflexivity is important.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I don't know.
I think it'd be interesting if you had watched this before Lost Highway.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a proto Lost Highway.
For sure.
Yeah.
But it's also an echo of Blue Velvet. And
yeah.
It sits, you know, thinking of tour-wise, I think thematically it sits between those because it's doing the Blue Velvet thing of this is your small-town America.
Mm-hmm.
It is not festivals and everybody's happy-go-lucky. There are people with issues and concerns and dangers here just as much as any other city, big mm-hmm. or small.
Mm-hmm.
But also in this symbolic Mobius strip thing approach that he does in Lost Highway, I think we're seeing it here. I mean, the fact that Heather Graham's Annie shows up before she's ever introduced later in the TV show in season two of the series,
yeah,
is very, I think, foreshadowy of the ideas he's going to play with in Lost Highway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just that. I mean, the fact that Coop and Shirley are in the Red Room
mm-hmm.
in the end is very much kind of playing with that same, but also that sort of, you know, the symbolism of alternate identities and, you know, Bob and Leland and Peter and Fred and, or is it Peter and Fred? Is that right?
Pete and Fred. Yeah.
Pete and Fred. Right. I mean,
yeah.
So it'd be interesting, I think, to see where you land on this, not having seen Lost Highway. Cause definitely, you know, I think this is a proto that, and then that's a proto. Like, I think he's just
iterating in some ways. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Cause that was something I remember while watching it, I was kind of bumping up against was like, I feel like this was much more, some of these ideas were really more well fleshed out in Lost Highway without putting the audience through kind of the ringer the way the end of Fire Walk With Me does. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of like kind of upsetting and intense stuff within Lost Highway to be sure. But this definitely goes harder, I think, inarguably. I think maybe where I like Lost Highway more is I feel like the way in which that character, or not that, I guess it's interesting how Lost Highway finds a way to give Patricia Arquette, I can't think of either of her character names right now. She's got two character names.
Renee and?
Yes. Nancy? Alice.
Alice.
Renee and Alice kind of get a win over the men trying to control them. And not exactly the same way that Laura Palmer does. But not dissimilar either. Like the ways in which like Lynch kind of gives them both moments of angelic serenity that cannot be conquered is sort of interesting. And I don't know if that's maybe a putting women on a pedestal thing that we need to unpack, or it is more about sort of the innate humanity and like violence does not define a person.
I think it's that. I think it's more the second.
That's kind of what I'm hoping for. Yeah. And this sort of, that's more what it's about. But I think that's more, we get more successfully into like the psychology in Lost Highway, I feel like, of like, there's no Bob to write it all off on. You know, the possessiveness, the controllingness, the sort of the ways in which Pete is, not Pete, but Fred, rather, saxophone Fred is like very internalized, like just constantly angry, playing saxophone, having sex with his wife, just like always like internal and like just rage. I think we kind of get more into like that psychology and like, where does this problem come from? Like, what is society doing to men that is making them all like a hair's breadth from being a nightmare to everyone around them? I think is kind of more put on the microscope much more interestingly in Lost Highway. Yeah. And again, I feel like Alice getting to entirely walk out of Lost Highway is more satisfying than, Laura Palmer seeing herself as an angel in the red room.
Right.
And maybe that's just because there's less mythology to deal with in Lost Highway, which makes it a cleaner narrative overall.
Well, yeah.
But I think, Arthur, you're so right to bring it up as like Blue Velvet, Fire Walk With Me, Lost Highway, sort of this
trilogy.
Yes. Especially because
Inland Empire is also of a piece with them as well, I would say.
I know it's very much about a woman in trouble, obviously, from the tagline. I mean, is that kind of his main thematic preoccupation?
Yeah, I mean that and the meta thing, which is again brought more to the fore in Inland Empire, next to the Fire Walk With Me.
But I mean, Mulholland Drive sits right there in the middle and is about the ways in which like Hollywood as an industry is, you know, part and parcel of all of these issues we're talking about.
Right, and it's the meta-ness is not media specific in that sense, but yeah. Lot to be said there. Well, I think we probably ought to pull this particular train into the station.
Yeah, you're just going to be talking about coffee and pie and larger theories if we go any longer.
Arthur, shelf or trash? What do you say for Fire Walk With Me?
Yeah, I think I would shelf this.
Yeah, good. What would you say, Dalton?
Not for me personally, sorry. But I mean, I feel like if you're going to get into Twin Peaks, you probably need to watch this too. Like
That's right, it's as trash as Dune is. That's the pull quote for the listicle.
That's the listicle
pull quote.
Clickbait.
Yeah, as bad as Dune. No, this is a good film. It is a challenging film, and I would not recommend you watch it the way that I did. I would recommend you probably watch both seasons of Twin Peaks before watching Fire Walk With Me. That is probably the more ideal experience.
Well, I think that's why it was so booed at Cannes, because they hadn't seen it, and they're like, I don't understand.
What are these people? Why are we watching them? Yeah, you don't think the Cannes audience was big into the TV show Twin Peaks? Well, Dustin, why don't you tell everyone what a big dipshit Tarantino is for saying he doesn't like Lynch anymore after this movie?
Well, he is an idiot, because I absolutely would shelf this movie.
Yeah,
it's great. In fact, I want to buy the fan supercut.
Is he an idiot?
Is Dalton an idiot?
Yeah.
Dalton just said it wasn't for him. He didn't say he has no interest in David Lynch and is done with him. So,
okay.
Yeah. It was not.
I think he's still one of the great American auteurs and is one of our great little freaks.
Mm-hmm. So, there you go, dear listener. If we are wrong, and we probably are, you can tell us via various means, and Dalton's going to tell you what they are.
Sure, why not? Yeah, you can record a cassette message for yourself, and if you dead drop that on 23rd and Klassen, I'll go pick it. No, you can send your long form feedback. Diane. It's February, what is it, 29th, 28th?
I don't know.
Yeah,
22nd.
I was going to say, bullshit, you don't know.
I don't remember.
Tell me you don't remember. All right, well, especially on February 22nd, we're going to need that feedback in the form of a cassette tape. The rest of the year, you can send us goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. That is where all your long-form feedback can go. goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. For whatever you're thinking about, do you have big overarching Twin Peaks theories you need to get out of your head and need Dustin to read? Boom, that's where you can send them. Do you need to let me have it for liking Lost Highway more than Fire Walk With Me? Okay, sure, man. That's where the email goes. goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. Do you need to tell Arthur how much you enjoyed the movie he sent you? There you go. GoodTrashOnCast@gmail.com.
Do not need to tell me that it's February 24th. We just looked it up. It is February 24th. Now we know.
Okay. Don't send Dustin the correction. He doesn't need it. If you want to send him a picture of the cat, he's on Instagram.
I like cats.
He's not on there as much as Arthur and I, but he is on there. You can follow us, speaking of, as a unit, at Good Trash Media over on social media. Mostly just Insta, but you know, we're on other places at Good Trash Media, goodtrashmedia.com for stuff that we have written. If you want to read some written reviews and written articles, last but certainly not least, if you were thinking to yourself, wait, I want to send Arthur an email about getting a DVD. Well, take yourself over to patreon.com/GTM. Find out, what tier you got to give at to get Arthur to send you a movie. He'll send you a little survey to fill out. He'll send it through the Arthurtron 9000 and come out with a great selection for you, sent directly to your door. Other things for you, like picking a show for the movie. Picking a movie for the show. There we go. Good Lord. Picking a movie for us to discuss on the show.
They're going to want us to guarantee something to go on Blank Check now.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're not going to be able to do that.
No, we can't make that happen, unfortunately. You can listen to us play Monster of the Week, though. That's something fun over on Patreon.
We had a good time.
Patreon.com/GTM for all that and more. Arthur, we're done. We're exiting the Red Room.
Yeah, we're beelining out of this Black Lodge.
Thank God. I need a break.
If we can ever really leave.
Oh, no.
Hey, guys, let's go watch Mulholland Drive right now.
No. Next week, though, we're out of the marathon. And I think we just need a little bit of a palate cleanser just to really lighten the mood a bit after all we have been witness to for the last 5 weeks. And so to do that, we're going back to 2001, right before the towers fell.
It is Mulholland Drive.
To watch Josie and the Pussycats.
Oh, maybe not.
Huzzah. Huzzah. That's right. A simpler time.
A much simpler time.
History had ended and had yet to resume.
So that's what's next. So you keep watching, we'll keep talking, and we'll see you all next time.